Rule 116 of Criminal Procedure, Arraignment and Plea. Section 1. Arraignment and Plea, How Made. Letter A. The accused must be arraigned before the court where the complaint or information was filed or assigned for trial. The arraignment shall be made in open court by the judge or clerk by furnishing the accused with a copy of the complaint or information, reading the same in the language or dialect known to him, and asking him whether he pleads guilty or not guilty. The prosecution may call at the trial witnesses other than those named in the complaint or information. Letter B. The accused must be present at the arraignment and must personally enter his plea. Both arraignment and plea shall be made of record, but failure to do so shall not affect the validity of the proceedings. Letter C. When the accused refuses to plead or makes a conditional plea, a plea of not guilty shall be entered for him. Letter D. When the accused pleads guilty but presents exculpatory evidence, his plea shall be deemed withdrawn and a plea of not guilty shall be entered for him. Letter E. When the accused is under preventive detention, his case shall be raffled and its records transmitted to the judge to whom the case was raffled within 3 days from the filing of the information or complaint. The accused shall be arraigned within 10 days from the date of the raffle. The pretrial conference of his case shall be held within 10 days after arraignment. Letter F. The private offended party shall be required to appear at the arraignment for purposes of plea bargaining, determination of civil liability, and other matters requiring his presence. In case of failure of the offended party to appear despite due notice, the court may allow the accused to enter a plea of guilty to a lesser offense, which is necessarily included in the offense charged with the conformity of the trial prosecutor alone. Letter G. Unless a shorter period is provided by special law or Supreme Court circular, the arraignment shall be held within 30 days from the date the court acquires jurisdiction over the person of the accused, the time of pendency of a motion to quash or for a bill of particulars, or other causes justifying suspension of the arraignment shall be excluded in computing the period. Arraignment defined. Arraignment is a procedure whereby the accused is brought before the court to plead to the criminal charge against him in the indictment or information. The charge is read to him and he is asked to plead guilty or not guilty. Purpose of arraignment. Arraignment is an indispensable requirement in any criminal prosecution. It is the stage where an accused for the first time is granted the opportunity to know the precise charge that confronts him. It is imperative that he is thus made fully aware of possible loss of freedom, even of his life, depending on the nature of the crime imputed to him. At the very least, then, he must be fully informed of why the prosecuting arm of the state is mobilized against him. An arraignment serves that purpose. Moreover, arraignment is a precondition for the court's acquisition of jurisdiction over the person of the accused to try and decide his case. To be precise, arraignment partakes the nature of an answer, as in civil cases, through which the issues of the case are joined and the trial court acquires jurisdiction to decide over the issues. Without such jurisdiction, any judgment rendered by the trial court would be null and void. It is for this evident reason that prior arraignment of the accused is indispensable in a trial in absentia. Thus, while the Constitution authorizes trial in absentia, there can be no trial in absentia unless the accused has been arraigned. It requires that the accused be arraigned so that he may be informed as to why he was indicted and what penal offense he has to face to be convicted only on a showing that his guilt is shown beyond reasonable doubt, with full opportunity to disprove the evidence against him. An arraignment thus becomes indispensable as the means for bringing the accused into court and notifying him of the cause he is required to meet. Prohibited motions before arraignment. Under the revised guidelines for continuous trial of criminal cases, The following motions are prohibited. They shall be denied outright before the scheduled arraignment without need of comment and or opposition. Number 1, motion for judicial determination of probable cause. Number 2, motion for preliminary investigation filed beyond the 5-day reglementary period in inquest proceedings under Section 6, Rule 112, or when preliminary investigation is not required under Section 8, Rule 112, or when allowed in inquest proceedings and the accused failed to participate in the preliminary investigation despite due notice. Number 3, motion for reinvestigation of the prosecutor recommending the filing of information once the information has been filed before the court. Letter A, if the motion is filed without prior leave of court. Letter B, when preliminary investigation is not required under Section 8, Rule 112. And letter C, when the regular preliminary investigation is required and has been actually conducted and the grounds relied upon in the motion are not meritorious, such as issues of credibility, admissibility of evidence, innocence of the accused, or lack of due process when the accused was actually notified, among others. Number 4, motion to quash information when the ground is not one of those stated in Section 3, Rule 117. Number 5, motion for bill of particulars that does not conform to Section 9, Rule 116. Number 6, motion to suspend the arraignment based on grounds not stated under Section 11, Rule 116. Number 17, petition to suspend the criminal action on the ground of prejudicial question when no civil case has been filed pursuant to Section 7, Rule 111. Meritorious motions under the revised guidelines. Motions that allege plausible grounds supported by relevant documents and are competent evidence except those that are already covered by the revised guidelines are meritorious motions, such as number 1, motion to withdraw information or to downgrade the charge in the original information or to exclude an accused originally charged therein, filed by the prosecution as a result of a reinvestigation, reconsideration, and review. Number 2, motion to quash warrant of arrest. Number 3, motion to suspend arraignment on the ground of an unsound mental condition under Section 11, Paragraph A, Rule 116. Number 4, motion to suspend proceedings on the ground of a prejudicial question where a civil case was filed prior to the criminal case under Section 11, Paragraph B, Rule 116. Number 5, motion to quash information on the grounds that the facts charged do not constitute an offense, lack of jurisdiction, extinction of criminal action or liability, or double jeopardy under Section 3, Paragraph A, B, G, and I, Rule 117. Number 6, motion to discharge accused as a state witness under Section 17, Rule 119. Number 7, motion to quash search warrant under Section 14, Rule 126, or motion to suppress evidence. And number 8, motion to dismiss on the ground that the criminal case is a strategic lawsuit against public participation, or SLAPP, under Rule 6 of the Rules of Procedure for Environmental Cases. The comment of the adverse party shall be filed within a non-extendable period of 10 calendar days from notice receipt of the order of the court to file the same, and the court shall resolve the motion within a non-extendable period of 10 calendar days from the expiration of the 10-day period, with or without comment. The court at its discretion may set the motion for hearing within a non-extendable period of 10 calendar days from expiration of the 10-day period to file comment, in which case the same shall be submitted for resolution after the termination of the hearing and shall be resolved within a non-extendable period of 10 calendar days thereafter. Reply and memorandum need not be submitted. In case of a motion to discharge accused a state witness under Section 17, Rule 119, where the prosecution is required to present evidence in support thereof, such motion shall be submitted for resolution from the termination of the hearing and shall be resolved within a non-extendable period of 10 calendar days thereafter. The motion for reconsideration of the resolution of a meritorious motion shall be filed within an unextendable period of 5 calendar days from receipt of such resolution, and the adverse party shall be given an equal period of 5 calendar days from receipt of the motion for reconsideration within which to submit its comment. Thereafter, the motion for reconsideration shall be resolved by the court within a non-extendable period of 5 calendar days from the expiration of the 5-day period to submit the comment. Motions that do not conform to the requirements stated above shall be considered unmeritorious and shall be denied outright. Notice of arraignment and pretrial. Under the revised guidelines, notice of arraignment and pretrial shall be sent to the accused, his or her counsel, private complainant or complaining law enforcement agent, public prosecutor, and witnesses whose names appear in the information for purposes of plea bargaining, arraignment, and pretrial. Procedure in arraignment. Generally, the procedure in arraignment follows letter A. The arraignment shall be made in open court by the judge or clerk by furnishing the accused with a copy of the complaint or information, reading the same in the language or dialect known to him, and asking him whether he pleads guilty or not guilty. Letter B, the accused must be present at the arraignment and must personally enter his plea. Both arraignment and plea shall be made of record, but failure to do so shall not affect the validity of the proceedings. Letter C, when the accused refuses to plead or makes a conditional plea, a plea of not guilty shall be entered for him. Letter D, when the accused pleads guilty but present exculpatory evidence, his plea shall be deemed withdrawn and a plea of not guilty shall be entered for him. Letter E, if the accused pleads not guilty to the crime charge, he or she shall state whether he or she imposes a negative or affirmative defense. Letter F, if the accused pleads guilty to the crime charge and the information, judgment shall be immediately rendered except in those cases involving capital punishment. In the latter case, the rule laid down in Section 3 of this rule shall be followed. If the accused does not enter a plea of guilty, whether to a lesser offense or to the offense charged in the information, the court shall immediately proceed with the arraignment and the pretrial in accordance with the succeeding provisions on pretrial. Language used in arraignment. The complaint or information should be read in the language or dialect known to the accused. The reading of the complaint or information to the accused in the language or dialect known to him is a new requirement which implements the constitutional right of an accused to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation towards him. It also responds to the reality that the Philippines is a country divided by dialects, and Filipino as a national language is still in the process of evolution. Thus, in a case the records did not reveal that the information against the appellant was read in the language or dialect known to him, the information against the appellant is written in the English language. It is unknown whether the appellant knows the English language. Neither is it known that what dialect is understood by the appellant, nor is there any showing that the information couch in English was translated to the appellant in his own dialect before his plea of guilt. The Supreme Court held that the arraignment is null and void. Waiver of reading of the information. In multiple cases, the court upon personal examination of the accused may allow a waiver of the reading of the information upon the full understanding and express consent of the accused and his or her counsel, which consent shall be expressly stated in both the minutes, certificate of arraignment, and the order of arraignment. The court shall explain the waiver to the accused in the language or dialect known to him or her, and ensure the accused's full understanding of the consequences of the waiver before approving the same. Periods to observe in arraignment. When the accused is under preventive detention, his case shall be raffled and its records transmitted to the judge to whom the case was raffled within 3 days from the filing of the information or complaint. The accused shall be arraigned within 10 days from the date of the raffle. The pretrial conference of his case shall be held within 10 days after arraignment. Under the revised guidelines, the arraignment of the accused and the pretrial shall be set within 10 calendar days from the date of the court's receipt of the case. If the accused is not under preventive detention, the arraignment shall be held within 30 days from the date of the court acquires jurisdiction over the person of the accused, unless a shorter period is provided by special law or Supreme Court circular. The time of dependency of a motion to quash or for a bill of particulars or other causes justifying suspension of the arraignment shall be excluded in computing the period. Under the revised guidelines, the court must set the arraignment of the accused in the commitment order in the case of detained accused or in the order of approval of bail in any other case. For this purpose, where the executive judge and bearing judges act on bail applications in cases assigned to other courts, they shall coordinate with the courts to which the cases are actually assigned for scheduling purposes. Section 7 of the Speedy Trial Act of 1998, prescribing the 30-day period for the arraignment of the accused, was held to be not absolute. In fact, Section 10 of the same law enumerates periods of delay that shall be excluded in computing the time within which trial must commence. Plea. Defined in its kinds. Plea is the response made by the accused in open court upon arraignment, in which the complaint or information is read to him in a language or dialect known to him, and such accused is asked whether he pleads guilty or not guilty to the offense charged. Plea of guilty is a plea whereby the accused admits his guilt freely, voluntarily, and with a full knowledge of the consequences and meaning of his act, and with a clear understanding of the precise nature of the crime charged in the complaint or information. Plea of not guilty is a plea whereby the accused denies his guilt or admits some of the allegations of the complaint or information but sets up or attempts to set up new or additional facts which, if proven, would exempt or relieve him in whole or in part of the criminal responsibility which would attach on proof of guilt of the crime with which he is charged. Conditional plea is one in which the accused pleads guilty to the offense but imposes a condition thereof, as when he admits his guilt provided a certain penalty will be meted out. Essence of plea of guilty. A plea of guilty must be an unconditional admission of guilt. It must be of such nature as to foreclose the accused's right to defend himself from said charge, thus leaving the court no alternative but to impose the penalty fixed by law. It is the essence of a plea of guilty that the accused admits absolutely and unconditionally his guilt and responsibility for the offense imputed to him. Hence, an accused may not foist a conditional plea of guilty on the court by admitting his guilt, provided that a certain penalty will be meted onto him. Neither an accused who pleaded guilty can on appeal successfully claim that his extrajudicial confession was given by force when plea of not guilty entered. A plea of not guilty should be entered in the records under the following instances. Letter A, when the accused pleads not guilty to the offense charge. Letter B, when he refuses to make a plea. Letter C, when he makes a conditional plea of guilty, as when it is made provided that a certain penalty may be imposed upon him. It is equivalent to a plea of not guilty and would therefore require a full-blown trial before judgment may be rendered. Letter D, when he admits the truth of some or all the allegations of the information but interposes excuses or additional facts which, if duly established, would exempt or relieve him in whole or in part of criminal responsibility. Letter E, when after a plea of guilt, he introduces evidence of self-defense or other exculpatory circumstances. Letter F, when the plea is indefinite, vague, or ambiguous. Thus, where during the trial, the accused appellant did not plead to a lesser offense, but pleaded guilty to the rape charges and only bargained for a lesser penalty, the trial court should have vacated such a plea and entered a plea of not guilty for a conditional plea of guilty or one subject to the proviso that a certain penalty be imposed upon him is equivalent to a plea of not guilty and would therefore require a full-blown trial before judgment may be rendered. Likewise, where the accused appellant was adamant in his denial of the charges filed against him despite his plea of guilty, the trial court should have required accused appellant to plead anew to the charges, or at least it should have directed that a new plea of not guilty be entered for him, since said testimony had the effect of vacating his plea of guilty. Thereafter, the court echo should have proceeded with the trial of the case to determine the guilt or innocence of accused appellant. When rearrangement proper. Under the following instances, rearrangement of the accused was held proper. Number one, where it appears that the accused appellant is a deaf mute, a mental retardate, whose mental age is only 7 years and 9 months, and with low IQ of 80 only, and was tried before, below, without the benefit of sign language expert, it was held that he richly deserves a rearrangement and retrial. Number two, where the trial court failed in its obligation to explain fully to the accused appellant the consequences of his plea of guilt and the probable penalty that may be imposed upon him, it was held that such failure is a ground to remand the case for rearrangement. Number three, where the information was amended but the accused was arraigned on the original information, the action of the trial court in setting aside the arraignment and in conducting a rearrangement of the accused on the amended information was held proper. Arraignment on an amended information. When the complaint or information is amended, the accused should be arraigned on the amended information. Where the accused has already been arraigned on the original information, he need not be rearraigned on the amended information if the amendment was only as to matters of form, as when the alterations introduced in the information refer to the inclusion of another accused. But where the accused was arraigned on the original and not on the substantially amended information, although such defect was pointed out on the trial court by defense counsel, the same constitutes reversible error. A mere change in the date of the commission of the crime, if the disparity of time is not great, is more formal than substantial. Such an amendment would not prejudice the rights of the accused, since the proposed amendment would not alter the nature of the offense. Presence of the private offended party. The private offended party shall be required to appear at the arraignment for purposes of plea bargaining, determination of civil liability, and other matters requiring his presence. In case of failure of the offended party to appear despite due notice, the court may allow the accused to enter a plea of guilty to a lesser offense, which is necessarily included in the offense charge, with the conformity of the trial prosecutor alone. Record of the arraignment. The rules provide that both arraignment and plea shall be made of record, but failure to do so shall not affect the validity of the proceedings. But it has been held that the absence of the record of arraignment renders the plea of guilty to capital offense invalid, and the absence of record cannot give rise to presumption of valid arraignment. Grounds of objection waived by pleading to the information. When the accused fails to move to quash the information and voluntarily submitted himself to the jurisdiction of the court by entering a plea, he shall be deemed to have waived the following objections. Letter A, the information does not conform substantially to the prescribed form, and all possible objections to the sufficiency of the information against him. Letter B, failure of the information to allege time with sufficient definiteness. Letter C, multiplicity of charges in violation of Section 13, Rule 110. It must be noted, however, that objection to multiplicity of offenses may be made before trial and not necessarily during the arraignment. Letter D, defects in the manner of his arrest. Letter E, the illegality of the arrest or any irregularity attending the arrest. But a waiver of an illegal warrantless arrest does not also mean a waiver of the inadmissibility of evidence seized during an illegal warrantless arrest. Violation of the rights to preliminary investigation. Letter G, violation of the constitutional right against unreasonable searches and seizure. but the effect of entering a plea as a waiver of certain objections was not applied in the following cases. Number one, where the accused filed a demurrer to evidence and objected and opposed the prosecution's formal offer of evidence, his plea and active participation in the trial would not cure the illegality of the search and transform the inadmissible evidence into objects of proof. Number two, where the accused has been actively and consistently demanding a regular preliminary investigation even before he was charged in court and refused to enter a plea during the arraignment because there was a pending case in the Supreme Court regarding his right to avail of a regular preliminary investigation. Arraignment and preliminary conference in mediatable cases under the rule on summary procedure. The arraignment and preliminary conference shall be simultaneously held, and the court shall take up all the matters required under Section 14, Rule on Summary Procedure, during the preliminary conference. The same rules of arraignment as in regular cases shall be followed. If the accused does not enter a plea of guilty, whether to a lesser offense or to the offense charged in the information, the court shall immediately proceed with the arraignment and the preliminary conference, and thereafter refer the case to mediation. Section 2. Plea of guilty to a lesser offense. At arraignment, the accused, with the consent of the offended party and the prosecutor, may be allowed by the trial court to plead guilty to a lesser offense which is necessarily included in the offense charge. After arraignment but before trial, the accused may still be allowed to plead guilty to said lesser offense after withdrawing his plea of not guilty. No amendment of the complaint or information is necessary. When an offense includes or is included in another, a lesser offense is necessarily included in the offense charge when the essential ingredients of the former constitute or form part of those constituting the latter. Thus, the crime of homicide is necessarily included in murder, of theft, in robbery, and of simple seduction in qualified seduction. Consent of the offended party. The rule requires the consent of the offended party and the prosecutor before an accused may be allowed to plead guilty to a lesser offense necessarily included in the offense charge. However, if the offended party failed to appear in the arraignment despite due notice, the court may allow the accused to enter a plea of guilty to a lesser offense which is necessarily included in the offense charge with the conformity of the trial prosecutor alone. Under the revised guidelines, if the accused desires to enter a plea of guilty to a lesser offense, plea bargaining shall immediately proceed provided the private offended party in private crimes or the arresting officer in victimless crimes is present to give his or her consent with the conformity of the public prosecutor to the plea bargaining. Thereafter, judgment shall be immediately rendered in the same proceeding when plea of guilt to a lesser offense not allowed. A plea of guilt to a lesser offense is not allowed when prohibited by law. For example, Section 23 of RA 9165, otherwise known as the Comprehensive Drugs Law, provides that any person charged under any of the provisions of this Act, regardless of the imposable penalty, shall not be allowed to avail of the provision on plea bargaining. This section, however, was declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in Estepona Jr. v. Lobrigo. A plea of guilty for a lighter offense than that actually charged is not supposed to be allowed as a matter of bargaining or compromise for the convenience of the accused. The rules allow such a plea only when the prosecution does not have sufficient evidence to establish guilt of the crime charge. Indeed, when such an offer is made, the court is duty-bound to inquire carefully into the circumstances on which it is premised. While this provision allows the accused in a criminal case to plead guilty to a lesser offense, which is necessarily included in the crime charge, the fact of death of the victim for which the accused was criminally liable cannot, by simple logic and plain common sense, be reconciled with the plea of guilty to the lower offense of attempted homicide. So also, where the prosecution has already rested its case, it is palpably irregular and legally erroneous to conduct for the trial court to allow the accused to withdraw his plea of not guilty to the offense of murder and substitute the same with the plea of guilty to the lesser offense of homicide and be credited with the mitigating circumstance of voluntary plea of guilty. plea of guilty to a lesser offense, its effect on the civil liability. The case of Mario Guevero versus Guihing Agricultural Development Corporation enunciates the rule that when the accused pleads guilty to a lesser offense with the consent of the offended party, the court may award damages corresponding to the offense charge. Modification of an affirmative plea to a lesser offense. If the accused pleads guilty to a lesser offense pursuant to a pretrial agreement, the agreement on the plea of the accused to a lesser offense may only be revised, modified, or annulled by the court when the same is contrary to law, public morals, or public policy. Section 3. Plea of guilty to capital offense. Reception of evidence. When the accused pleads guilty to a capital offense, the court shall conduct a searching inquiry into the voluntariness and full comprehension of the consequences of his plea and shall require the prosecution to prove his guilt and the precise degree of culpability. The accused may present evidence in his behalf. Rationale of the rule. The rationale behind the rule is that courts must proceed with caution where the possible punishment is in its severest form. Example, death, for the reason that the execution of such a sentence is irrevocable, and experience has shown that innocent persons have at times pleaded guilty. The primordial purpose of the rule is to avoid improvident pleas of guilt on the part of an accused where grave crimes are involved, since he might be admitting his guilt before the court and thus forfeit his life and liberty without having fully understood the meaning, significance, and consequences of his plea. The procedure also helps the Supreme Court fulfill its duty of reviewing death sentences. Procedure when accused pleads guilty to a capital offense. If the accused pleads guilty to a capital offense, the trial court must first conduct a searching inquiry into the voluntariness of the plea and the accused's full comprehension of the consequences thereof. Second, require the prosecution to present evidence to prove the guilt of the accused and the precise degree of his culpability. And third, ask the accused if he desires to present evidence on his behalf and allow him to do so if he desires. This procedure is mandatory, and a judge who fails to observe it commits grave abuse of discretion. In every case where the accused enters a plea of guilty to a capital offense, especially where he is an ignorant person with little or no education, the proper and prudent course to follow is to take such evidence as are available and necessary in support of the material allegations of the information, including the aggravating circumstances therein, enumerated, not only to satisfy the trial judge himself, but also to aid the Supreme Court in determining whether the accused really and truly understood and comprehended the meaningful significance and consequences of his plea. Necessity of a searching inquiry. The rules require the judge to conduct a searching inquiry into the voluntariness of the accused plea of guilty. A searching inquiry under the rules means more than informing cursorily the accused that he faces a jail term, but so also the exact length of imprisonment under the law and the certainty that he will serve time at the national penitentiary or a penal colony. Not infrequently, indeed, an accused pleads guilty in the hope of a lenient treatment or upon bad advice, or because of promises of the authorities or parties of a lighter penalty should he admit guilt or express remorse. It is the duty of the judge to see to it that the accused does not labor under this mistaken impressions. In People v. Alamsida, the Supreme Court found the trial court to have failed in observing that quantum of care which it had prescribed for the valid admission of a plea of guilty by an accused, especially in capital cases, when it did not explain to the accused the nature of the charges against him, particularly the allegations regarding conspiracy, treachery, evident premeditation, and abuse of superior strength, which are terms so technical that the layman, especially an unschooled one like the accused in the said case, cannot possibly understand without proper elucidation. The High Court stressed that the plea of guilty to a capital offense is null and void where the trial court inadequately discharged the duty of conducting a searching inquiry. Guidelines in conducting searching inquiry.
The Supreme Court has, in several cases, prescribed the following guidelines on the manner in which a searching inquiry should proceed. Number one, ascertain from the accused himself, letter A, how he was brought into custody of the law. Letter B, whether he had the assistance of a competent counsel during the custodial and preliminary investigations. Letter C, under what conditions he was detained and interrogated during the investigations. This is intended to rule out the possibility that the accused has been coerced or placed under a state of duress, either by actual threats of physical harm coming from malevolent quarters or simply because of the judge intimidating ropes. Number two, ask the defense counsel a series of questions as to whether he had conferred with and completely explained to the accused the meaning and consequences of a plea of guilty. Number three, elicit information about the personality profile of the accused, such as his age, socioeconomic status, and educational background, which may serve as a trustworthy index of his capacity to give a free and informed plea of guilty. Number four, may inform the accused of the exact length of imprisonment or nature of the penalty under the law and the certainty that he will serve such a sentence. For not infrequently, an accused pleads guilty in the hope of a lenient treatment or upon bad advice or because of promises of the authorities or parties of a lighter penalty should he admit guilt or express remorse. It is the duty of the judge to ensure that the accused does not labor under these mistaken impressions, because a plea of guilty carries with it not only the admission of the authorship of the crime proper, but also the aggravating circumstances attending it that increase punishment. Number five, inquire if the accused knows the crime with which he is charged and fully explain to him the elements of the crime which is the basis of his indictment. Failure of the court to do so would constitute a violation of his fundamental right to be informed of the precise nature of the accusation against him and a denial of his right to due process. Number six, all questions posed to the accused should be in a language known and understood by the latter. Number seven, the trial judge must satisfy himself that the accused in pleading guilty is truly guilty. The accused must be required to narrate the tragedy or reenact the crime or furnish its missing details. Presentation of evidence. It must be stressed that under this rule, even upon a plea of guilty to a capital offense, evidence should be adduced before the trial court can impose the corresponding punishment for the offense upon which that plea is predicated. The presentation of evidence is required in order to preclude any room for reasonable doubt in the mind of the trial court or the Supreme Court on review as to the possibility that there might have been some misunderstanding on the part of the accused as to the nature of the charge to which he pleaded guilty and to a certain circumstances attendant to the commission of the crime which justify or require the exercise of a greater or lesser degree of severity in the imposition of the prescribed penalty. The rationale behind the rule is that courts must proceed with more care where the possible punishment is in its severest form, death, for the reason that the execution of such a sentence is irrevocable, and experience has shown that innocent persons have at times pleaded guilty. The use of the auxiliary verb shall suggests that this procedure is mandatory. Proof of aggravating circumstances. Under settled jurisprudence, the aggravating circumstances alleged in the information must be explained to the accused when he pleads guilty to a crime imputed against him. Where the aggravating circumstances listed in the information are not supported by the evidence adduced, a plea of guilty to a capital offense cannot constitute an admission of the aggravating circumstances set forth in the information. A plea of guilty to a capital offense cannot constitute an admission of aggravating circumstances which were not shown to exist from the evidence adduced. Thus, a plea of guilty cannot be held to include treachery and evident premeditation where the evidence adduced does not adequately disclose the existence of said qualifying circumstances. In a case, although appellant pleaded guilty to the charge as alleged in the information, it was held that evident premeditation may not be taken against him since the evidence presented by the people does not adequately disclose the existence of the same. When improvident plea of guilt loses its significance, the manner by which the plea of guilt was made, whether improvidently or not, loses its legal significance where the conviction is based on the evidence proving the commission of the accused of the offense charge. who has also accused appellant's plea of guilty was improvidently made, there is no need to remand the case to the lower court for the reception of evidence in view of the fact that there exists other evidence on which accused appellant conviction may be based. Independently of his plea, there is sufficient evidence showing that accused appellant indeed committed the crime with which he is charged. Also, where the trial court extensively received evidence in determining the guilt of the accused, the manner in which the plea of guilt was made, whether improvidently or not, loses its significance for the simple reason that the conviction of the accused was based on the evidence proving his commission of the offense charge and not on his admission in open court. His conviction may only be set aside when the improvident plea of guilt was the sole basis for the condemnatory judgment. Section 4. Plea of guilty to non-capital offense. Reception of evidence discretionary. When the accused pleads guilty to non-capital offense, the court may receive evidence from the parties to determine the penalty to be imposed. Section 5. Withdrawal of improvident plea of guilty. At any time before the judgment of conviction becomes final, the court may permit an improvident plea of guilty to be withdrawn and be substituted by a plea of not guilty. Reception of evidence. When the accused pleads guilty to a non-capital offense, the court may receive evidence from the parties to determine the penalty to be imposed. The employment of the auxiliary verb may suggest that reception of such evidence is discretionary on the part of the court. Withdrawal of improvident plea of guilty. At any time before the judgment of conviction becomes final, the court may permit an improvident plea of guilty to be withdrawn and be substituted by a plea of not guilty. Withdrawal of plea of guilty during trial. While the rule is silent on the matter, a plea of not guilty can likewise be withdrawn so that the accused can plead guilty to the same offense, but for obvious reasons, this must be done before the promulgation of judgment. The accused can confess guilt at any time, even after arraignment and after trial has begun, but the law is clear that he shall not thereby be entitled to have such plea considered as a mitigating circumstances. A plea of guilty is not mitigating when it was made after the prosecution had commenced the presentation of its evidence. Section 6, duty of court to inform accused of his right to counsel. Before arraignment, the court shall inform the accused of his right to counsel and ask him if he desires to have one. Unless the accused is allowed to defend himself in person or has employed counsel of his choice, the court must assign a counsel de officio to defend him. Fourfold pre-arraignment duties of the judge. The trial court has the fourfold duties under Section 6 of this rule, namely number 1, to inform the accused that he has the right to have his own counsel before being arraigned. Number 2, after giving such information, to ask accused whether he desires the aid of counsel. Number 3, if he so desires to procure the services of counsel, the court must grant him reasonable time to do so. And number 4, if he so desires to have counsel but is unable to employ one, the court must assign counsel de officio to defend him. Compliance must be of record. Trial courts are admonished to ensure that their compliance with pre-arraignment duties to inform the accused of his right to counsel, ask him if he desires to have one, and to inform him that unless he is allowed to defend himself in person or he has counsel of his choice, a de officio counsel will be appointed for him, must appear on record. However, it is settled that the failure of the record to disclose affirmatively that the trial judge advised the accused of his right to counsel is not sufficient ground to reverse conviction. The reason being that the trial court must be presumed to have complied with the procedure prescribed by law for the hearing and trial of cases, and that such a presumption can only be overcome by an affirmative showing to the contrary. Thus, it has been held that unless the contrary appears in the record, or that it is positively proved that the trial court failed to inform the accused of his right to counsel, it will be presumed that the accused was informed by the court of such right. Section 7, Appointment of Counsel de Officio. The court, considering the gravity of the offense and the difficulty of the questions that may arise, shall appoint as counsel de officio such members of the bar in good standing who, by reason of their experience and ability, can competently defend the accused. But in localities where such members of the bar are not available, the court may appoint any person resident of the province and of good repute for probity
and ability to defend the accused. Section 8, time for counsel the official to prepare for arraignment. Whenever a counsel the official is appointed by the court to defend the accused at the arraignment, he shall be given a reasonable time to consult with the accused as to his plea before proceeding with the arraignment. Appointment of counsel the official. The duty of the court to appoint a counsel the official is not mandatory where the accused has proceeded with the arraignment and the trial with a counsel of his choice, but when the time for the presentation of the evidence for the defense was due, he appears by himself alone because of the inexcusable absence of his counsel. Responsibility of counsel the official. Counsel the official has the duty to defend his client and protect his rights, no matter how guilty or evil he perceives accused to be. The performance of this duty is all the more imperative when the life of accused hangs in the balance. His duty is no less because he is counsel the official. A counsel the official is expected to do his utmost, a mere pro forma appointment of the official counsel, who fails to genuinely protect the interest of the accused merits disapprobation. The exacting demands expected of a lawyer should be no less than stringent when one is a counsel the official. He must take the case not as a burden but as an opportunity to assist in the proper dispensation of justice. No lawyer is to be excused from this responsibility except only for the most compelling and cogent reasons. Time to prepare for arraignment. Whenever a counsel the official is appointed by the court to defend the accused at the arraignment, he shall be given a reasonable time to consult with the accused as to his plea before proceeding with the arraignment. This rule applies where the accused is represented by counsel de parte. The fact that the accused hired new lawyers to represent him does not justify the postponement of the arraignment over the strong objection of the prosecutor. There is no reason why a different rule should be applied to a counsel de parte whose services have just been engaged by the accused. The counsel could be required to confer with the accused within a shorter period to prepare her for the arraignment. Section 9, Bill of Particulars. The accused may before arraignment move for a bill of particulars to enable him properly to plead and prepare for trial. The motion shall specify the alleged defects of the complaint or information and the details desired. Bill of Particulars defined. A bill of particulars is a pleading which provides for a more definite statement of the allegations in the complaint or information found to be vague or ambiguous to enable the accused to properly plead and prepare for trial. Purpose of a bill of particulars. It has been held that it is the function or purpose of a bill of particulars to define, clarify, particularize, and limit or circumscribe the issues in the case to expedite the trial and assist the court. Its function is to amplify or limit a pleading, specify more minutely and particularly a claim or defense set up and pleaded in general terms, give information not contained in the pleading to the opposite party and the court as to the precise nature, character, scope, and extent of the cause of action or defense relied on by the pleader and apprise the opposite party of the case which he has to meet to the end that the proof at the trial may be limited to the matter specified, and in order that the surprise at and needless preparation for the trial may be avoided and that the opposite party may be aided in framing his answering, pleading, and preparing for trial. It will clarify and correct at an early stage the kind of doubt which the accused entertains. Filing of motion. The accused may before arraignment move for a bill of particulars to enable him properly to plead and prepare for trial. The motion shall specify the alleged defects of the complaint or information and the details desired. It must likewise conform to the requirements of Rule 15, Rules of Civil Procedure, more importantly, Section 4, 5, and 6 thereof. Issue in a motion for bill of particulars. The only question to be resolved in a motion for a bill of particulars is whether or not the allegation of the complaint or information are averred with sufficient definiteness or particularity to enable the movant properly to prepare his responsive pleading and to prepare for trial. When bill of particulars proper. The remedy against an indictment that fails to allege the time of commission of the offense with sufficient definiteness is a motion for bill of particulars. Also, when the allegations in the information are vague and ambiguous, or where the allegations of the complaint are deficient because the averments therein are mere conclusions of law or presumptions unsupported by factual premises, a bill of particulars is proper. If the information failed to allege with certainty the time of the commission of the offense, the remedy of the accused is to move either for a bill of particulars or for the quashal of the information on the ground that it does not conform substantially to the prescribed form. Allowance of motion, discretionary. The allowance of a motion for a more definite statement or bill of particulars rests within the sound discretion of the court, and as usual in matters of a discretionary nature, the ruling of the trial court in that regard will not be reversed unless there has been a palpable abuse of discretion or a clearly erroneous order. Modes of compliance. A party ordered by the court to make a more definite statement or to serve a bill of particulars may comply, letter A, by filing and serving a bill of particulars containing the statement sought for, which bill becomes a part of the complaint or information, or letter B, by amending the original complaint or information and indicating therein the amendments by appropriate marks. Section 10. Production or inspection of material evidence in possession of prosecution. Upon motion of the accused showing good cause and with notice to the parties, the court, in order to prevent surprise, suppression, or alteration, may order the prosecution to produce and permit the inspection and copying or photographing of any written statement given by the complainant and other witnesses in any investigation of the offense conducted by the prosecution or other investigating officers, as well as any designated documents, papers, books, accounts, letters, photographs, objects, or tangible thing not otherwise privileged, which constitute or contain evidence material to any matter involved in the case and which are in the possession or under the control of the prosecution, police, or other law investigating agencies. This section is similar to Rule 27 of the 1997 Rules of Civil Procedure, except that this is available only to the accused. Leave of court required. The accused must seek leave of court under this section, which may be granted upon due application with notice to the parties and a showing of good cause. An accused is ordinarily entitled to the production of books, documents, papers, and other tangible things which are material and relevant to the establishment of his defense. Requisites for the issuance of order. In order that an order for production and inspection may be issued, the following requisites must concur. Letter A, there must be a motion showing good cause, therefore. Letter B, the document must constitute or contain evidence materials to any matter involved in the case. And letter C, the documents, etc., must be in the possession or under the control of the prosecution, police, or other law investigating agencies. Section 11, suspension of arraignment. Upon motion by the proper party, the arraignment shall be suspended in the following cases. Letter A, the accused appears to be suffering from an unsound mental condition which effectively renders him unable to fully understand the charge against him and to plead intelligently thereto. In such case, the court shall order his mental examination and, if necessary, his confinement for such purpose. Letter B, there exists a prejudicial question, and letter C, a petition for review of the resolution of the prosecutor is pending at either the Department of Justice or the Office of the President, provided that the period of suspension shall not exceed 60 days counted from the filing of the petition with the reviewing office. The addition of the third ground was dictated by Solar Team Entertainment. Period of suspension. Under paragraph A of this rule, the arraignment of the accused shall be suspended until he recovers his mental faculties. Under paragraph B, such a suspension shall last until the termination of the civil action. Under paragraph C, the period of suspension shall not exceed 60 days. In the latter case, it behooves the Secretary of Justice to resolve the appeal within that period. When accused is of unsound mind, the arraignment of an accused shall be suspended if at the time thereof, he appears to be suffering from an unsound mental condition
of such nature as to render him unable to fully understand the charge against him and to plead intelligently thereto. Under these circumstances, the court must suspend the proceedings and order the mental examination of the accused, and if confinement be necessary for examination, order such confinement and examination. If the accused is not in full possession of his mental faculties at the time he is informed at the arraignment of the nature and cause of the accusation against him, the process is itself a felo de se, or self-murder, for he can neither comprehend the full import of the charge nor can he give an intelligent plea thereto. The question of suspending the arraignment lies within the discretion of the trial court, and the test to determine whether the proceedings will be suspended depends on the question of whether the accused, even with the assistance of counsel, would have a fair trial. In passing on the question of the propriety of suspending the proceedings against an accused person on the ground of present insanity, the judges should bear in mind that not every aberration of the mind or exhibition of mental deficiency is sufficient to justify such a suspension. The test is to be found in the question whether the accused would have a fair trial with the assistance which the law secures or gives. Test of accused competency to stand trial. In determining an accused's competency to stand trial, the test is whether he has the capacity to comprehend his position, understand the nature and object of the proceedings against him, to conduct his defense in a rational manner, and to cooperate, communicate with, and assist his counsel to the end that any available defense may be interposed. This test is prescribed by state law, but it exists generally as a statutory recognition of the rule of common law. There are two distinct matters to be determined under this test. Number one, whether the defendant is sufficiently coherent to provide his counsel with information necessary or relevant to constructing a defense. And number two, whether he is able to comprehend the significance of the trial and his relation to it. The first requisite is the relation between the defendant and his counsel, such that the defendant must be able to confer coherently with his counsel. The second is the relation of the defendant vis-a-vis the court proceedings, that he must have a rational as well as factual understanding of the proceedings. When a prejudicial question exists, Section 6 of Rule 111 provides that a petition for suspension of the criminal action based upon the pendency of a prejudicial question in a civil case, in a civil action, may be filed in the office of the prosecutor or the court conducting the preliminary investigation. When the criminal action has been filed in court for trial, the petition to suspend shall be filed in the same criminal action at any time before the prosecution rests. The elements of a prejudicial question are: letter A, the previously instituted civil action involves an issue similar or intimately related to the issue raised in the subsequent criminal action, and letter B, the resolution of such issue determines whether or not the criminal action may proceed. When petition is pending before the Department of Justice or Office of the President, the arraignment of the accused may be suspended if a petition for review of the resolution of the prosecutor is pending either the Department of Justice or the Office of the President, provided that the period of suspension shall not exceed 60 days counted from the filing of the petition with the reviewing office. Where the Secretary of Justice exercises his power of review only after the information has been filed, trial court should defer or suspend arraignment and further proceedings until the appeal is resolved. Procedurally speaking, after the filing of the information, the court is in complete control of the case, and any disposition therein is subject to its sound discretion. The decision to suspend arraignment to await the resolution of an appeal with the Secretary of Justice is an exercise of such discretion. A court can defer to the authority of the prosecution, armed to resolve once and for all the issue of whether or not sufficient ground exists to file the information. In several cases, the High Court emphatically caution judges to refrain from arraigning the accused precipitately to avoid a miscarriage of justice. In the Matulak v. Villon
The judge in that case hastily arraigned the accused despite the pending appeal of the accused with the DOJ and notwithstanding the existence of circumstances indicating the probability of miscarriage of justice. Said judge was reminded that he should have heeded the court's statement in Marcelo versus CA that prudence, if not wisdom, or at least respect for the authority of the prosecution agency, dictated that he, respondent judge therein, should have waited for the resolution of the appeal then pending with the DOJ. Archiving of cases. Under the revised guidelines, the archiving of cases shall be done within the period prescribed under the guidelines in the archiving of cases under SC Administrative Circular No. 7A-92 as restated in OCA Circular No. 89-2004. A criminal case shall be archived only if, after the issuance of the warrant of arrest, the accused remains at large for 6 months from the delivery of the warrant to the proper peace officer. Such case shall likewise be archived when proceedings therein are ordered suspended for an indefinite period because, letter A, the accused appears to be suffering from an unsound mental condition which effectively renders him unable to fully understand the charge against him and to plead intelligently or to undergo trial, and he has to be committed to a mental hospital. Letter B, a valid prejudicial question in a civil action is invoked during the pendency of the criminal case unless the civil and criminal cases are consolidated. Letter C, an interlocutory order or incident in the criminal case is elevated to an pending resolution decision for an indefinite period before a higher court which has issued a temporary restraining order or writ of preliminary injunction. And letter D, when the accused has jumped bail before arraignment and cannot be arrested by the bondsman.